Hello, Bulak listeners. Ursula here. As we prepare a new season, today we're rerunning an episode that commemorates the Egyptian Revolution. 15 years ago, between January 25th and February 11th of 2011, enormous crowds took to the streets of Egypt to call for the end of the Mubarak regime. Marsha and I were both in Cairo at that extraordinary and hopeful time. Mubarak was pushed out, but Islamists and the army began almost immediately jostling for power. Less than 2 years later, security services carried out the Rabaa massacre, and the army carried out a coup that led to General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi becoming president, which he still is today. History was distorted or denied, and many of the country's activists persecuted. One of these was Alaa Abdel Fattah. After a decade in and out of prison on spurious charges, Alaa was finally released last fall and allowed to travel outside Egypt in December. Today's episode was recorded in 2021 and discusses Alaa's book, You Have Not Yet Been Defeated, an anthology of his wide-ranging writing on activism, capitalism, technology, prison, family, and how to face repression and loss. We also talk about several other works that were inspired by the Egyptian uprising and its aftermath. Hello, everyone. It's a new year and a new season of the Bulak podcast. We're very happy to be back. I'm Ursula Lindsay here in Amman, Jordan, and I'm joined as always by my friend Marsha Links-Quayle in Rabat. Hi, Marsha.
Hi, Ursula. So this is our 79th episode, and we are recording around the time of the 11th anniversary of Egypt's January 25 revolution. So we'll be talking about three writers and their works that sort of reflect that revolution and what happened afterwards. As Ursula already mentioned, You Have Not Yet Been Defeated by Alaa Abdel Fattah, which was translated by a collective of friends, family, supporters of Alaa's, and it is a big book, and there's so much to talk about. We'll also be talking about Ahmed Duma, who published a poetry collection last year called Curly with Dar Mareya, and Basma Abdelaziz's Here is a Body, which was translated by Jonathan Wright and is newly out in English as well.
So to begin with Alaa Abdel Fattah, who is perhaps the best known of these people internationally, because he's an activist who's been in and out of prison now ever since the Egyptian Revolution, and is fairly well known thanks to all the campaigns of support, I think, that have been organized around him.
And thanks in part also,
Alaa comes from a family.
Thanks in part, I think, also to his work, as in technology and in computer sciences and in sort of, RiceCon and speech issues in general. I think he was already like an important figure internationally, as well as in Egyptian politics.
Yeah. So Alaa, like you said, he was a blogger in the early Egyptian blogosphere when it sort of took off as a space for activism. And he and his partner and then wife, Manal, had a really important site called manala.net, where they aggregated blogs from all over the region, I think, and also where they sort of fostered a lot of conversations about technology, about freedom of expression, about digital rights, about citizen journalism. He comes from a family of activists. His father is a very prominent and beloved human rights lawyer. His mother is a professor who's also a political activist. And he has two younger sisters who became very involved in activism with the revolution and after the revolution, and have had their own stints in jail. And Alaa was sort of One, I mean, not the, you know, there's so many, you know, prominent and figures of the Egyptian Revolution, but he was certainly one of the very well-known ones. And he was, you know, followed on Twitter by hundreds of thousands of people, I think. And he expressed, I think, the Shabab al-Thawra, you know, the revolutionary youth point of view. I think he was one of the thought leaders of it, you know, one of the people who was commenting in real time and taking positions in real time as events were unfolding, and was very influential and very well regarded. And because of his opposition to the army, and because of his opposition to like the Ancien Regime and to all sort of the efforts to co-opt and repress that took place after the revolution, he very quickly started being prosecuted on a whole number of trumped up cases, frankly, one after the other. And he spent the majority of the last decade in prison. And he has just been convicted to another 5-year term in jail for a tweet. For retweeting something, he just got 5 years in jail.
Right.
So, and then this book has come out. Like you said, it's a collection of his writing.
Yes, and I think one of the things that you can see immediately from this collection of his work is that not only was he a leading activist and voice, but a tremendously original thinker, wide-ranging issues about everything about our contemporary world and technology and capitalism and AI and this book ranges between philosophy, political science. I think it's really a must-read in terms of political science, history, and he has these flights of poetic language as well that really make it a pleasure to read. It's a collection of all sorts of different works. Some of them are interviews that are transcribed. Some of them are pieces he wrote in prison. Some of them are pieces he wrote outside of prison. Some of them are tweets of his. All assembled, I imagine, by this translators collective, and it is not a book that, you know, reads as a narrative, but it builds a kind of, you know, entire huge world that you can really live in and go back and read different parts. It's really a masterwork, a must have, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is chronologically organized. So basically, it spans from right after the outbreak of the Arab Spring in Egypt for the next 10 years, from 2011 to 2021. And at the beginning of the book, it has a timeline. And so you can kind of follow what's happening to him. And there's notes so that, this, like you say, the speeches and the posts and the essays are contextualized. And then I think I don't know how it reads to someone who isn't already familiar with these events, because I was reading it, of course, having been there for a lot of the things that are mentioned in the book, or at least followed them quite closely. So it's also interesting to be reminded of everything that happened. Mm. And then, although I was quite familiar, I mean, I had met Alaa. He's a very good friend of friends. And I knew who he was, like I said, since 10 years before the revolution, because he was been active for a very long time. So I sort of had an idea of who he was, but I had not read at all of his writing, which should be said is done, I think, almost exclusively in Arabic. And so it was really great to see what he had written about certain things that I remembered, what positions he had taken, what thoughts he had had at certain moments. It's very impressive because he's so right on so much of the time.
Right.
I mean, and not in the sense that he always, you know, has a strategy or even thinks there's something to be done. Some of the junctures are completely hopeless. But in the sense that his response is always so interesting, honest, like,
right,
you know, humanly and politically, like, admirable, it's a really interesting way to sort of revisit the history of the last 10 years in Egypt from the point of view of this leftist, committed, internationalist activist, and sort of
right, who always feels like he's listening to the world. I always felt that there were new inputs coming in, and he's so, as you say, yes, this is structured chronologically, and so you can see, you know, the development of different thoughts over this decade that the collection covers.
Yeah, and of course, there's this terrible arc to it, because, you know, the history of the last 10 years in Egypt has been like a year of hope, a year of, you know, chaos, anxiety, violence, like uncertainty. And then, you know, ever since then, just a darkening landscape for certainly for anybody who is committed to what he, for example, what Alaa defines as the minimum demands of the Egyptian revolution, which were, by his definition, a rotation of power and a protection of the human body, of the basic dignity of the human body from violence.
Right.
And those are the two minimum demands. And certainly, you know, there's been a regression on both fronts ever since the end basically of any sort of open, contested political space that had been opened by the Arab Spring back in 2013. So the arc of it is tragic. You start at the beginning and he's proposing how the new constitution should be written.
Right.
And then, you know, very soon he's dealing instead with massacres, with judicial prosecution, with himself, with long prison sentences. And the question becomes, how do we deal with this failure? How do we analyze it? How do we make something useful of it? And I think also on a personal level, how do I survive this?
Mm.
Like mentally, emotionally, and intellectually survive this.
Right. But I think to me, what's so different from some of the fiction, let's say, that follows this arc of tragedy, is that there are so many lucid moments of, I don't know, not just beauty, but understanding that, and so many moments that resonated that I felt lifted above the moment, the understanding I felt sort of, I don't know, remade along the way. I really took such pleasure in reading from this book that I, you know, that sometimes I don't in reading fiction that is just, you know, relentlessly grim and showing me how terrible everything has become.
No, of course, because there's the pleasure of his intelligence and of his humor. Mm. And also I think there's this great struggle to maintain some form of hope and to maintain some form of meaning. I think there was a reading that we had talked about
right, from Five Metaphors.
Yeah,
right.
Do you want to?
From Five Metaphors on Healing. Yeah, I would love to. So this is in five sections, Five Metaphors on Healing. And I'll read from the last one, Regeneration.
Do you want to first say what the previous sections, like where it was written and what the other sections say?
So this was, it says, written in the Kiosk of Solitude, Do'i Police Station, published in 2019 in Madamassar. So this is from the later section of the book. There can be no return to paradise lost, for we were not born innocent. There can be no resurrection, for we are not holy, and our sacrifices were not consciously made. No surgery can cure us, and no medicine, for the decision to amputate is not ours, and no clinical research was conducted to explain away our ailments. There will be no rebuilding, as the land itself can no longer withstand any more clearing. Let us postpone the wandering of our souls till after death, for each one of us is haunted by comrades who departed, and it would not do to leave them desolate before their time. If we are to be treated like animals with no agency, so be it. But we shall bypass cattle and livestock, ignore pets and domesticates. We shall look to the lizards, starfish, and earthworms, those beings that can regenerate after any injury, no matter how grave. We shall accept that regenerated organs may not be identical to what was lost. They could appear to be mutilated, but look closer and you will see the beauty and monstrosity. For only the monstrous can hold both the history of dreams and hopes and the reality of defeat and pain together. The monstrous need not forget their old injuries in order to lose their fear of acquiring new ones. And I think that's just objectively so beautiful.
Yes, and so thought-provoking. And like you said, this was written basically after he had served his first 5-year jail sentence and come out and was being held to an interpretation of parole that required him to turn himself in every night to the local police station and spend the night in the police station and basically lose 12 hours a day, which is something that he's...
And much more in transit to and from the police station.
Yeah, and it's clear from some of the other writings and the interviews around this time that he found this process of handing himself in after he had already served his jail term, handing himself in every day, excruciating. And he writes this essay and, you know, quoting Nietzsche and Lenin and James Baldwin, and the passage that you read it's sort of inspired by Donna Haraway's A Cyborg Manifesto, you know, and Derrida and Benjamin. And he looks at all these different metaphors on healing. And before he gets to the final one that you read on regeneration, he sort of goes through all these other ways to think of coming back to life, rebirth, amputation, recycling, haunting. And then he settles on this beautiful image of the monstrous regenerated creatures that sort of keep their wounds, but grow past them.
But sprout new limbs, yes.
Yeah. And yeah, it's one hopes that he can go on feeling this way himself. I mean, I find the book very moving on like a really individual level, because it's also the story of like, how does one person who is a very remarkable and well-intentioned human being like withstand this level of persecution, of unjust endless imprisonment, and of course he's not the only one. Of course he is one of like thousands, tens of thousands of political prisoners.
Right, 65,000, which is a number that I've seen.
Yes, of estimated political prisoners in Egypt.
And this sort of under such a mercurial system that, as he describes, sometimes he'll be able to have access to books, and sometimes he won't. Sometimes he'll have access to news coverage, and sometimes he won't know what's going on in the outside world. Sometimes he has access to. So there's a piece that he wrote about the situation of Uber in Egypt that I found so interesting on so many levels, and you know, about the way in which Silicon Valley funds things and the way in which it sort of plays out specifically in Egypt, and the ways in which new initiatives are suppressed in Egypt, and then these, you know, these gigantic foreign, hugely funded initiatives are allowed to crush sort of local things. But then the positive sides of it in terms of, you know, the white taxi being such an area of sexual harassment. There's a later interview then asking him, how did you write this piece? And, you know, him saying that there are moments when he was allowed news from outside. He was allowed to read magazines only, you know, not necessarily the magazines he wanted, that not always the books that he wanted, but from this sort of mosaic of things, he was able to pull out such interesting observations about not, you know, Egypt and then our entire world and how it's built. And I just felt so illuminated by these different moments and from such sort of meager things that they're allowing him in, such meager inputs.
Yeah, you can feel that it's a mind that's like thirsting for stimulus and that it must be very painful for him not to have it. And like you said, that there's an awareness of technological developments and technological implications. I mean, the things he says just about the way social media affects communication, the kind of tone and communication that he finds on social media and that he finds shocking when he comes out of prison after 5 years and hasn't been on it. A lot of these, and also what I find very, like you said, he's so aware, like his awareness of his outlook, which is global, which is like aware of the international dimension of political questions, but which is completely not in the like fake hyper-nationalist paranoid, you know, it's a foreign conspiracy, but used, you know, to justify local repression, which is like so much of the discourse in Egypt, like a suspicion of everything that comes from the outside that is like completely self-serving.
Right.
Whereas he is, you know, genuinely critical of imperialism, of capitalism, of like certain forms of like international violence and coercion, and wants to imagine international alternatives, but he imagines making those alternatives with people around the world.
Right, right.
Like he's not locked into this endless like nationalism, which is so pernicious. And in fact, of course, the reason he was considered to be such a number one target threat and one of the first people that they like went locked up along with some others and, you know, tried to destroy is because he had explicitly said, you know, that the state, the Egyptian state was the problem. The Egyptian army was the problem. Like all of that needed to be, you know, taken down and built back up from the ground.
Right.
And that's the discourse that's like unacceptable. Anyway, he's a very, very interesting thinker. And it's a great historical record, the book. It's incredibly thought provoking and it's very moving.
And also, I think in addition to never succumbing to these small nationalisms, he also can put himself in the position of somebody who's not, you know, people must have asked him again and again, what can I do to help? And, you know, he has this sort of fix your own democracy, which I think is, you know, so important for people to remember that, you know, any country, particularly the one of which I'm a citizen, the United States, is a tremendously flawed system of small democracy. And yeah, so how are you going to help Egypt, fix your own system? Now, I haven't the slightest idea how to go about that. But, you know, he also has these other, you know.
Well, the United States just sold Egypt like $2.5 billion worth of weapons.
Right. And so why is it?
I think a day ago, if we were a more responsive democracy, some of our own decisions around things like that, perhaps.
Right. Responsive to people rather than to capital and companies.
Right. I think that's the argument is like have strong democracy, have strong human rights in your own country, and you might make decisions in the global arena that will be beneficial for us too.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's such a, you know, it could be something that sounds flippant at first, you know, fix yourself. But I do think that it's sort of profound. Yes, that is what needs to happen.
Well, also he says it's the only place where you have influence, and he's right. Like we can't, you know, the way the world is structured right now as a foreign citizen, you don't have particular influence in Egypt, but
right.
The one place where you have rights that you should be trying to exercise is in your own country. By the way, I don't know if you're picking up background noise on my end.
Yeah, like a little traffic or something.
It's trees being cut down on my street because of this enormous snowstorm that we had in Amman. And so if you hear a little rumbling, this is all the trees that got knocked over and fell over power lines because we had this really big snowstorm 2 days ago are now being cleared. Just wanted to give you a heads up. Another one of the very moving pieces that's included in this book is a piece of writing that Alaa writes as a duet, as an exchange with another political prisoner, Ahmed Duma. And that's another thing I find interesting about Alaa's book is how many different kinds of writing he tries out too.
Yes, yeah.
Like how many different formats. There's reportage, there's essay, there's memoir. Like he's always trying to find interesting ways of expressing himself. But so he and Duma wrote this long piece. Duma's entries are more poetic and Alaa's are more sort of written like mini essays. I'm not sure exactly how it was composed, but they sort of clearly went back and forth kind of taking off from each other's last bit and then published this long piece that's kind of an exchange. And you've just published some work of Duma, and Duma remains in prison. Duma's been sentenced to prison for life, right?
Yes. So Duma, just to give a little bit of background about him, he was born at the end of the 80s in 89, and he was raised in a family that was sort of brotherhood leaning. But when he heard about Kefaya, which was a pro-democracy movement in the Mubarak years in the mid, you know, in the early 2000s, he left for Cairo and he joined in part of this. He supported the April 6th worker strike in Mahalla al-Kubra, which was in 2008. And he, along with a couple others, he founded the April 6th Youth Movement, and which was one of sort of the central groups in the initial initial 2011 uprising. And he had also been arrested previously for solidarity with Gaza, So he was part of, you know, a big part of the original uprising in 2011. And he was not a Morsi supporter despite sort of coming from a brotherhood family. That's, I think from his poetry, you can see that that's not where he ended up. But he also, he was not among those who supported the Rabah and Nahda massacres, and he participated in a 2013 protest against the new anti-protest laws, and that's when he was arrested and sentenced first to 3 years in jail, and then while he was in prison, he was retried, given a million some dollars fine and sentenced to life in prison. And he's been in prison ever since, and some of those years in solitary and confinement. And I understand from Elliot Kola currently that he does have a phone at the moment and that sometimes Elliot and others are able to talk to him. But that he spent much of his time in isolation and some of the work, we published two of the poems translated, co-translated by Ahmed Hassan and Elliot. And one of them, an excerpt from it, Blasphemy, was written in isolation. And another poem comes from his new collection, Curly, which he published in 2021 with Dar Mareya. But on the eve of its publication, security officials came and confiscated copies of the book, and Elliot calls that an effort to erase one of Egypt's bravest, most crucial voices. And I know Elliot is currently struggling to get some attention from PEN, the writers' organization, to Ahmed Duma's case. I don't know how effective these things are, but I think remembering I still think that these are important voices, and certainly the publication of these works and these voices are critical to what we do. Now, I think, you know, there's been some debate about, you know, sort of literary quality and publishing poems as a form of activism that I think is a question that we can all talk about. I certainly agree with Imen Marcel, and I find myself quoting her far too much, but that yes, we publish these poems, and yes, it is if we can even possibly budge getting somebody out of prison by publishing these poems, yes, we do it. And it, you know, we also publish a gigantic tent. We also publish other works, poems that about flowers and poems about, you know, of extreme aesthetic value, and these poems that may have some sort of instrumental value as well.
Do you want to read one of them?
I would read from Blasphemy, which is now again translated by Ahmed Hassan and Elliot Gola. Nothing is more precious than the opening of a new window onto the world or onto freedom. This is true everywhere, but it is especially true here. Our world is measured by the freedom we possess. We might spend our whole life boring a hole to squeeze through. Here, the complex problem we face has to do with the thickness of the walls. They are impenetrable. Yes, the window remains one-sided as ever. But as I tell my soul and its wishes, the window is merely the beginning of error. It is confusing that it looks at you while you cannot see. Very confusing. But most important of all is this. The ability to see means that you are alive and that despite everything, you have agency. This fact explodes the jailer's intentions and the prison's goals, which resembles stagnation, cruelty, and hostility to life. Allow me then to breathe this space with you, to take merely a breath without purpose or aim, as I might smoke a cigarette on the balcony of my house, now ruined by absence. As I might kiss my beloved, I look around now but do not find her. Has she too gone away? Or even as I might pray, not out of duty, but out of an abundance of longing. Only this, I close my eyes, spread my wings, and take my time sniffing around this empty space. And that's just part of, that's just an excerpt from Blasphemy, written in isolation, which, you know, I don't know, I find hard to imagine writing at all in isolation.
I mean, to respond to what you were saying before about, you know, writing, bringing attention to the case of people or bringing attention to the cases of writers who are imprisoned, or things like Penn or these campaigns. I mean, it seems to me in Egypt today, it doesn't have a track record of doing much in terms of actual getting people out of prison.
Mm.
I mean, frankly, they do what they want. They keep who they want. There's been some releases in the last year, I think, as part of negotiations with the U.S. and the EU of some Egyptian activists, but you know, Alaa has a very high profile, and he was just convicted to a new 5-year sentence, despite a lot of attention to his case.
Right.
I'm not sure that. I mean, of course, there's sort of. It's worth paying attention to every single person who is imprisoned unjustly, and I think. If that person happens to write, not only do they want their writing to get out to the world, presumably. It's one of the only ways that they can connect to the outside. And for them to know that it does reach the outside, I think is a comfort.
Yes, I do. I mean, I've been told, you know, publishing work that's of sort of substandard literary value, and actually, I found several moments in Blasphemy very beautiful and interestingly, you know, interestingly organized, you know, interestingly phrased, framed, but that it sort of, you know, distorts Arabic poetry and Arabic literature and makes it only about.
So, sorry, you've been told that you shouldn't have published these poems on your website because they're not.
Well, not these particular ones, not these particular ones, but in the past.
So people just have a you've heard criticism of them on a literary level.
Yes.
Their literary value.
Yes. And that the idea is that by elevating poems by political prisoners in particular, that these get more attention than other literary work, and thus people don't see the whole richness and excellence of Arabic literature, and they think Arabic literature is only poems written by prisoners.
I mean,
I just don't see it. So personally, my position is, I think I'm already obvious that I don't see that they're not running, you know, at least Arab Lit runs zillions of, well, zillions is maybe an exaggeration. A lot of.
You do. I think you do run zillions of things. Yeah. So just make sure to have a lot of all the other things so that the breadth and depth of, so that, yes, if that was the only thing that was being run or the main thing, you know, but it's more a question of what other things might be absent. I mean, it seems difficult to me to not, I mean, there is a human level too. I mean, you're talking about a person who is a significant figure also, so that their writing is also important historically, maybe, like,
right.
You know, this is a leader of revolutionary youth organizations. That's been like terribly repressed, like, I don't know, to be reminded of their existence and their thoughts now and their feelings, and does not seem to me to not have its worth. Can we make differentiations still? Like, it's not that you can't make literary judgments. It's not like someone's politics and your respect, your deep admiration, or your great sympathy for their situation has to not let you make literary judgments. You can, although I think one should, you know, in this situation, like, err on the side of kindness. But I mean, one of the things that is remarkable about Alaa Abdel Fattah's book, for example, is that I think it delivers on every level. Like, it delivers on the literary level, right? Like, it's not just that you're reading it.
Right. It delivers on the philosophical level. It delivers on bringing you new ideas.
Which is particularly, yeah, like, impressive, because a lot of these things were written in the moment and quickly and thrown out, you know, and like the tweets are memorable, you know, when he comes out of prison and he's the ghost of springs past. And at the moment that Raba is happening, he has this series of tweets as they're building up towards the massacre and the coup, where, you know, that are both witty and hopeless, and every single one, you know, is sort of capturing the spirit of the moment. There's so much of the writing that is like, that has so much voice, and the voice is a pleasure to spend time with.
Yes, absolutely. You do feel like you are spending time with him throughout this
so
book.
That's what I think makes that book is not going to just be of human interest or historical interest or, you know, interest in terms of advocacy. It's a book that is going to remain, you know, of interest for a long time, because it unites all those elements. Right.
Right. Right.
And not every book and every form of, and not every writing of every political prisoner, not most of them is going to necessarily have all those qualities.
Right. Or of anybody.
But that's fine.
I mean, most, right. Yeah, most literature doesn't live past, you know, the month or the day or that it was published. And that's okay. I think that's important too. Things that just live for a day or a week or a month.
Right. And I do find, because we have talked about a lot of different forms of prison writing, there's unfortunately like a lot of it in the region in the last century. Like it is such a developed genre. There's so many writers that we know personally or that, you know, we admire who have either spent time in prison or written about prison. And I do find the very act of, I mean, almost besides whatever critical judgment I can have on the final product, but I do find something moving about the very determination that people who are in these conditions have to like record their existence, record their story, and try to like share that and try to make sure that they don't disappear and that they use writing to do that. It's an extraordinary function of writing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so the prison novel is considered to be a separate genre in Arabic in a way that it's not in English. And I regret that there isn't a prison novel in English because in the United States, I can't really speak for other English language majority countries, but in the United States, prison is a feature of life for such a large percentage of the population. The fact that there isn't a prison novel, I think, speaks to, you know, to so many things about access to publishing. But I think there, I don't know, there should somehow be a novel, a genre of prison literature in a bigger genre of prison literature in the United States.
You know, I have made quite a bit of progress through Ahmed Naji's prison memoir. And he was also in prison at the same time as Alaa. Like they overlapped and they were both trying to get books in at the same time and dealing with the same like very arbitrary set of rules about what books they could bring in. At one point, Ahmed Naji, who'd been convicted, he's a writer who'd been convicted on obscenity charges, was told that he couldn't have any books about sex and Alaa couldn't have any books about politics. And so Alaa apparently joked like, oh, well, I'll just get all the sex books and he can get all the politics books and then we'll exchange.
Right.
There's especially considering what the experience of the generation that participated in the Egyptian revolution has been of the last 10 years, there's going to be a lot of writing about and out of prison. I mean, every single prominent figure that was involved in organizing or in political life has either been put in jail, been put on trial, gone into exile, or faced some sort of form of very violent harassment in the last decade. Like,
and so many others who, I mean, a friend of mine who's a science fiction writer who just, you know, just happened to be swept up and spent months and months in prison before he was able to get released for nothing. So
right.
It becomes a feature of life for so many people who were not activists or organizers.
Right. In fact, for more people like that than anybody else. In fact, yes, that's actually the kind of prison memoir that's missing from Arabic literature is the non-political one.
Right.
And
right.
Actually,
and this particular person who I'm thinking of, you know, doesn't want to remember that time
right.
or be defined by that time either.
Right.
Or risk going back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was back in Egypt in November, so 2 months ago, and I hadn't been back in 2 years. And it's always like a wave of emotions when I go back. And it's this weird kind of feeling of time traveling, right? Because you're in a different temporal frame of reference, like every time you go back to a city where you used to live. And I mean, it does feel like what happened there 11 years ago has been sort of like completely erased. And at the same time, the erasure is so intentional and so violent that it feels like it's maybe can't work. Like,
Right. So visible, such a visible erasure.
It's so, I mean, like, nobody can talk about it anymore except the president, who only talks about how terrible it was. And, you know, everything's been cleaned up. I mean, all physical, you know, any signs of it, any memories of what happened. And I actually had a chance to sort of have a coffee with the writer of the third book we're going to talk about today. So with Basma Abdelaziz, who wrote The Queue, which was a very well-received and I think very cool book that came out 4 or 5 years ago, I think, in English already.
Yeah, it was translated by Elizabeth Jacquette. It was several years ago, maybe 2017. I'm not sure exactly. It came out in 2013 in the Arabic, I'm almost certain.
It's this very atmospheric, again, it always gets described with the word dystopian. The problem with that is that, like, it doesn't really imagine anything beyond what's actually happening. It just sort of places right. it in a slightly alternate reality. I mean, it's the queue because there's this giant gate that where everybody has to go for everything they need and where all these rules keep coming out of, but the gate is closed. And so this giant line is forming outside of it. And, you know, it's in this atmosphere of you know, repression and like obfuscation. And there's a character who's been shot in these protests, but because officially nobody's been shot in the protests, the bullet that's inside him can't officially exist, so he can't get treatment. You know, so it's just sort of
right.
Reality.
You can't even get the X-ray with showing where the right. bullet is. Yeah, the whole novel, everything seems to sort of move through quicksand. Everything becomes so difficult. And yeah, even though I think I must have read it 5-6 years ago now, it's still, yeah, many of these scenes are still so vivid for me.
It's very powerful. It takes things that, I mean, like, for example, I heard when people were shot in clashes with the police during the uprising and in all the clashes that happened afterwards, I heard stories about bullets disappearing, like
right.
from hospitals, yes. bullets that would have been evidence. And we all know that there's pressure on doctors and on forensic authorities to like falsify reports, to not say the true cause of death or the true cause of injuries when they happen in these clashes.
Right.
And so for her to go with one, all she did was just take it one step further. It's that he has a bullet, but that bullet can't exist. And so it's this reality distortion imposed by the regime. Like, we're denying that we shot protesters, and therefore, you know, you can't possibly have this injury, and therefore your X-rays have to disappear, and like, no doctor can treat you. And it's very effectively rendered, the sort of mechanism of it. So that was her previous book. And now she's written this book called Here is a Body, and it's translated by Jonathan Wright. And it also takes off from reality. It's closer to reality, I would say, than the previous book. It has sort of two
narratives. Sometimes you feel sort of, as people say about a memoir, the face of the author coming through. Sometimes you feel, I felt the sort of the face of reality coming through, and sort of, you know, telling me this is what happened.
Yeah, that's a nice way. That's a very nice way of putting it. I do think, there's two narrative strands, and one narrative strand, although the name of the place and the event has been changed in a minor way, it is clearly an account of the sit-in at Rabah Square by supporters of the deposed Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi in the summer of 2013. So Morsi, after all these big protests, was removed from power, was detained by the army. And his supporters didn't accept this turn of events and had this huge sit-in. And then the sit-in was cleared in what's probably the worst massacre in modern Egyptian history that killed at least 800 people in a day.
Right.
Probably more than 1,000. And that is, I mean, although, you know, things have been minorly changed, there's no overt reference to Rabah or the Muslim Brotherhood or so on, but it's clearly...
No, but they're just called, you know, the encampment is called The Space. The Muslim Brotherhood is called Raised Banner. But I think they map pretty clearly to events.
And we should say also, like, this moment, so this is the moment at which not so much the protests against Morsi or Morsi being detained, but the moment at which the new military-headed regime committed this act of enormous, spectacular state violence and then got away with it with complete impunity is, I think, the founding moment of the regime that we live in Egypt today. Like, it's the turning point. It's the point at which people like Alaa knew that it was over. I mean, you know, he says in his book, like, if we don't call this a crime, if we don't clearly call this a crime, like, we become the city of the people who can do no right. Like,
right.
You know.
Yeah, and Basma's book doesn't end with the massacre, but rather shows this sort of afterlife of the people who were there at the protest camp, who survived, and how their lives are shrunken, and they can't exist, and the children are sort of shunned, and they're not allowed to speak about it, this terrible thing that happened to them at all.
And Basma is a trained psychiatrist, and she worked for a long time at the Nadim Center, which was the foremost center that gave treatment to victims of torture. I think a lot of her description of trauma is based on her actual practice. Like, she has seen these cases, she has talked to people in these situations. It's factual. And then, as a novelist, she invents, you know, characters and composites and situations, and also her description of the space and the clearing and all this, she told me, is, you know, is accurate. It's not, she didn't make things up. Like, that part, she wanted it to be historically accurate. As you say, it's meant to remind people of what happened. It's meant to be a record of something, because the event itself has been completely erased. Like, that's something that is almost like unmentionable now.
Right, right. And it becomes unmentionable at the end of the book. Yeah, I did find, as I was reading about moments in the protest camp, like remembering, oh yes, I remember when that was on TV. Yes, I remember those stories in the news. So it did feel like revisiting something that happened. So I don't know if you talked to her about why a novel and why not.
Actually, I don't think I asked her that. She's written other works of nonfiction, but I don't think she has like a cut. I mean, she's written books about torture, I think.
Yes.
And, but I don't know, actually. That's a good question. Maybe it would be even more difficult to write about it as nonfiction. At least with fiction, you have a thin veneer.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I don't think you can get a book published that's like, says the word Rabah in it.
Right, right.
In Egypt today. Unless it's some sort of condemnation and, you know, validation of the security operation to wipe the city out. Like, And when she tells it as a story, she weaves the thread. So she also, the sit-in is told from the point of view of sympathetic characters who join the sit-in. We're given this middle-aged couple who go there with their kid. So she has the daring, because there's no, I mean, in sort of mainstream Egyptian discourse, there's just no sympathetic depictions of the participants in that sit-in, the victims of that massacre. Like, they are, because they were immediately condemned as terrorists.
Right. And this woman, Aida, who is sort of the main character with whom that we follow in the space, I found tremendously sympathetic. Now, she's not a member of the Raised Banner or the Brotherhood. She's, you know, somebody who believed that Morsi, or I guess he was never named, whoever it was, had been democratically elected and that he should not have been deposed. And that she felt that being part of this protest camp would be an effective way to pressure the state into returning him to governance. And she's a teacher, and she's she's kind, and it is critical of different things that happen in the space. And it is certainly critical of the Brotherhood and many opportunists who are a part of the Brotherhood for financial and other benefits. But she and her family and a few others are particularly female characters, women characters are sympathetic.
Yeah. I mean, I found the character sympathetic. I have to say that I didn't find myself super enthralled by any of them. I think in a way in this book, the recounting of the events kind of overwhelms some of the development of character and even some of the plotting, some of the more like literary considerations. I think it is a sort of bigger, more sprawling, more messy book than her first book. And, you know, it's so sort of like caught up in making sure that it covers everything that happened. And you feel it at the end, you know, she's just kind of stuffing in like more and more of these outrages because she wants to kind of make sure that it's all recorded.
Right, right.
That sometimes some of the characters are a bit, you know, their motivations are not very clear to me, or they sort of take sudden shifts. You know, it seems to me like they do things more so you can see certain things happen than necessarily because it felt always like organic.
Right,
to,
right. Although to me, it was so startling. I just have to admit that to embody this character, sympathetic character in Roba was, I don't know, it was so startling to me. I was very engaged just for that reason. And then also, I haven't read anything that goes over all these events. And I did want to revisit them.
Yeah.
So we haven't talked at all about the other strands. So there are two, it does take place in two strands from two narrators. Or hers is actually, Ida's sections are third person while the others are first person. And it begins with this homeless teenager who's sort of kidnapped and, you know, turned into one of the bodies. So this is the sort of titular bodies who is brought to a facility with a bunch of other kids who were swept up from the streets and kind of stripped of their names and their identities and given these lessons and brought to barracks and then kind of turned into a kind of a unofficial state paramilitary force.
Yeah, I mean, again, which is not that far, like turned into Beltageya, which is a category of people who exist.
Right.
Like I used to go to demonstrations and there'd be these guys standing across the street all like, you know, civilians looking really tough. And at some point they would be deployed to beat up the protesters, even though they weren't police. They'd clearly been brought there in a police van. And so this strategy of having, you know, there's sort of untranslatable word, but, you know, sort of like hired thugs, like state-backed muscle, it's not at all beyond the realm of possibility. She imagines that they actually round up street kids, which there are hundreds of thousands of homeless children in Egypt, and there's long been this kind of like preoccupation with them and what to do with them, and that those are the kids who are then trained to be attack dogs for the state in this camp. Again, I found the beginning very like sharp, and you know the description of it, you're like immediately very caught up in what's happening to these boys,
right?
But the training in the camp less so, in the sense that it felt a bit like a kind of like summary again of all the various forms of like discourse that were used to indoctrinate, you know, people into kind of hatefulness and loyalty to the state. But it didn't feel, it felt like transcriptions almost of the kind of things that were said and are continue to be said, You know what I mean? Like, it's not a departure.
Yeah,
it's
I do.
It's very much the reality.
Right. But I mean, I think it's such an, so let's imagine that it wouldn't be possible to write this as nonfiction. I mean, it's not, doesn't take much of a leap of imagination. So that this exists as a, I don't know, this fictional record of things that happened. Yeah, that some of the things that happened among the bodies and the heads and in the indoctrination. Yeah, I mean, maybe could have been, I don't know, trimmed down or shaped more. But I don't know. I really felt compelled by it nonetheless. I did want to read, and I was interested to read. Of course, there's no possible spoiler because we know what happened because it was the past. But I wanted to see how these two strands came together.
Even that, though, I felt I kind of knew within a couple chapters how they were going to come together.
Well, sure. I think it's pretty clear how they're going to come because the boys are separated at the beginning. I think it's pretty clear how it's going to come together. I just was still compelled to see it happen and how they would react.
And you said, you know, let's imagine this book couldn't exist as nonfiction, which I think is true. It can barely exist as fiction because the book, though it was published in Arabic, is basically under this kind of, like, if not a ban, a sort of blackout, where instructions have been given for it not to be distributed, not to be displayed, not to be sold at bookstores, not to appear at the Cairo Book Fair, not to be reviewed. So it doesn't exist officially, this book. It's been sort of the book itself, which is an attempt to, like, keep the historical record from being erased. The book has been quite successfully erased in Egypt. And the English translation, which is available from AUC internationally, was not available in Egypt when I was there. They would have to import the book in. And I think at that point it would face, when you import books into Egypt, they go through customs and they go through various forms of censorship. And it should be said, I don't think there's a chance in hell that Allah's book would ever be available in Egypt. And Ahmed Duma's book, as you said, has been banned. So we're talking about three different authors. All of their work is unavailable.
Right. Except by the sort of means by which work, remains, in available online or available brought in people's suitcases or available in, one way or another. But yes, by and large, erased from the space of public discourse.
I mean, and that's not to say that I think it's pointless to write these things at all. In fact, I think it's perhaps extra admirable to write something when you're not sure when it's putting you at risk to write it in the first place, and you're not sure if it's even going to find the audience that you hope it will, and you're not sure when it will be allowed to become part of the shared narrative.
Mm.
Alaa Abd El Fattah has multiple points in his book where he talks about, like, our failure as revolutionaries is that we couldn't come up with a good story of what we wanted. Like, that's what a revolution has to have. We have to have a story that people believe in about what we want to accomplish. Even if we fail, at least we have that. And of course, I think in all revolutions, like, what they try to do immediately is, like, change the story, right? Muddle it, distort it. They don't even have to come up with something, like, persuasive on the other side, and I don't think they have. Just throw so many, like, threats and lies and stuff at you that your story doesn't make sense. People aren't sure what to believe, and then scare people into just not saying what they know and what they maybe do believe.
Mm.
Just scare them into not saying what they saw with their own eyes.
Right.
And so I think all these attempts to resist that are admirable, and I do hope that eventually they will be part of the record.
Right. In many languages, especially in Arabic. And so I'm going to read, to take us out, something that from the 23rd of September, 2014, so a while ago, from the memorial service for Allah's father, Ahmed Saif al-Islam, who died while he was in prison. All that's asked of us is that we fight for what's right. We don't have to be winning while we fight for what's right. We don't have to be strong while we fight for what's right. We don't have to be prepared while we fight for what's right, or to have a good plan, or to be well organized. All that's asked of us is that we don't stop fighting for what's right.